CBSI on the World. I'm John Batzel with Professor Brenda Schaefer, Dr. Schaefer at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Right now, the author, Brenda Schaefer, is here for Iran is More Than Persia, Ethnic Politics in Iran. This is a revelation about a state that the whole of Eurasia regards as a threat. Iran is now providing war-fighting material to Russia to attack Europe, Ukraine. In effect, not even in effect, Iran is at war with NATO right now. So what does that mean about Iran's strength, internal strength? I learned from Brenda's book that the Persians, the Tehran Persians, dominate the country in an imperial fashion that is indistinguishable from the two shahs, that is indistinguishable from the sovereign powers of kings. Brenda, you pose the democracy conundrum that these ethnic minorities are not going to stay loyal to Tehran if there's a vote. What is striking about this is an additional puzzle. This is something that the regime believes, which is why they persecute the minorities, but that the opposition, heretofore understood as the anti-regime opposition of, say, the Greens, also believe this. Please explain that.
Right. So, you know, people that are looking now at this wave of anti-regime protests, I keep hearing analysts write and say, wow, all the minorities are in this together. Isn't it wonderful how unified they are? Part one and part two are not necessarily the same. I mean, there are a lot of minority groups that wanted to get rid of the Soviet Union. That doesn't mean they didn't have different agendas once, you know, once the Soviet Union was weak or once, you know, once it had collapsed. So I think Iran is discovering, yes, right now that Persians, Kurds, Turks, Baluch, people could be united in getting rid of the Islamic Republic. But once that happens, they're going to have a huge dilemma. And if the Persian mainstream opposition wants to establish democracy, they're going to have to allow language rights, cultural rights for minorities, and this is something that at this stage they're not prepared to do. You know, they're saying that no, you'll just have to stay in with us and under the Persian language. Well, as I showed in the book, you know, from internal Iranian data. Okay, so this is data that the Iranian government is looking at. 40% of Iranians don't identify themselves as fluent in the Persian language. So it's kind of hard to imagine they want to embrace a system where, you know, they're not even fluent in the language. The minorities, they not only do they have cultural discrimination, linguistic discrimination, but they're the poorest in the country. They have the biggest health threats, the biggest environmental threats. I'm just thinking of, you know, some anecdotally, there's natural gas shortages in Iran. Believe it or not, even though Iran has the second largest gas volumes in the world, they don't produce enough gas. And they use the nice, clean natural gas for Tehran, for the central cities, but for the minorities, they throw fuel oil there to produce electricity and heat. And they talk about, you know, this sort of ethnic pollution in the sense that polluting air is okay for the Ahwazis and for the Azerbaijanis. The Persians get the nice, clean air. So as this goes forward, I was analyzing the Soviet Union in the 80s and early 90s. This feels to me very much like the maybe 1990 USSR, maybe not the final days, but going towards it, something that very few of us understood it then, only in retrospect when you look at it, you know, the signs were there. It feels very similar to me with complete, you know, the people losing the lack of, you know, complete lack of fear despite the repression, complete lack of legitimacy of the regime, you know, the regime only having sticks and no carrots. So it feels very similar, but what is very different is where the Russians were willing to let most of the republics go, at least at the time, Central Asia, Caucasus, Baltic states, and just, you know, sort of establish a state, you know, reestablish independence in Russia itself. You know, the Iranian opposition and government, no one's willing to let the minorities go, and not even just to go, but to have any sort of, you know, self-rule or cultural autonomy. And I believe this is likely going to lead to a you know, not a pretty picture implosion of the Islamic Republic, not as graceful even as the fall of the Soviet Union, which was relatively, it was bloody, but it could have been a lot bloodier than it was. I mean, this could easily descend into civil war after the collapse of the Islamic Republic.
Yes, it is striking in your book to discover that the Pahlavis, who were brutal, imperialists, and operated with the condescension of the modern state of the U.S. and as an ally of the U.S. Once they were gone, the Ayatollah's regime made promises, but then became the Pahlavis all over again. No distinction whatsoever. I want to emphasize something that's in your book again and again. The brutality towards the ethnics is constant, and they've gotten used to it. But the anti-regime reformers, are they opposed to the protests we're seeing today? Because many of them live in the diaspora. I didn't see the logic of that until I read about this democracy conundrum. There is no state as they imagine it to be reformed. It doesn't exist. Do they accept that?
So, you know, I think in the West, we're often surprised. We assume that people that are, you know, anti-regime, whether it's in this Russia or Southeast Asia or Iran, we assume that they're somehow globalist too and don't have like a, you know, a nationalist identity. We don't get it. I think people were surprised to learn that Navalny, for instance, supported the Russian occupation of Georgia and is likely, you know, supports the occupation of Ukraine. And, you know, it doesn't make sense. Wait, if you're one of our good guys, then don't you support the whole, you know, the whole Western agenda, right? So I think this is part of it too, you know, almost across the political spectrum in the diaspora and in Iran, people want to get rid of the Islamic Republic, but they have a very, again, when it comes to Persians versus the minorities, a very different picture about what happens after that. And I think the regime uses that. I think that they're constantly sending messages. You see this even in their press today. Hey guys, you know, either you stay with us and we hold this whole thing together, or you might end up, you know, losing territory. And they also pits the ethnic groups against each other. So especially Kurds and Azerbaijani Turks, especially Lurs and Arabs, they definitely use the, you know, sort of existing competition between groups to bring into open conflict.
Oh, let's speak of foreign policy. You've mentioned Azerbaijan and Armenia and their conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh that suited the Iran regime. But it also, you also mentioned foreign policy of the Kurds. What is the regime's thinking about the Kurds? This is, of course, the origin of the present protests was the murder of a young Kurdish woman. Is that a threat to the regime? How have they responded?
Well, I think the regime has tried to pivot this to, you know, towards external enemies and say, you know, so there's been like two rounds of missile attacks on Kurds in Iraq. There's been this saber rattling against Azerbaijan. And, you know, and trying to say that, you know, that this uprising is, you know, is about these foreign actors. But of course, I don't think it works for them at all. I think it's probably, you know, counterproductive. People are quite savvy and, you know, and they know that this is homegrown and, you know, and in fact, it's quite grassroots. I mean, some people are always complaining, well, this can't succeed because it doesn't have leadership. But actually, maybe that's the reason it can succeed, because it doesn't have leadership. It can't be decapitated. And it has so much support that it really doesn't need leadership and guidance. It just keeps, you know, reoccurring, you know, from the grassroots level.
And the lesson here, then, as we saw with the Soviet Union, there is the potential for the Azerbaijani Iranians to join Azerbaijan. There's an opportunity for the Kurds of Iran to join Kurdistan, northern Iraq. Are there comparable opportunities for the Awazi? Because that's the oil-rich, natural gas-rich part of the country.
Definitely what you're describing, I think, is why we need to be watching. I mean, think Iran and Russia that are almost, you know, they have a maritime border in the Caspian, right? Both countries are in an extremely volatile situation. I mean, the whole region's in a really volatile, you know, situation. I don't know how, if it's always appreciated by, you know, Brussels and Washington and stuff, how revolutionary, you know, how what's happening in Iran can affect every neighboring state. And even, you know, I'm constantly posting to oil watchers, you know, events that are happening in Khuzestan and, you know, that basically even Iran's oil could go off, you know,
Khuzestan off market. Khuzestan is the province where the Ahwazi Arabs live and is where all of the natural gas and 80% of the oil is from Khuzestan. Please continue, Brenda.
Okay. So, yeah. So, I mean, Khuzestan is one of the most volatile regions of Iran, and it's its main oil and gas producing region. It's a node of highways, of ports. I mean, you could have, you know, extreme spike in the global oil price with the increase of instability in Khuzestan. And, you know, that I would say is a likely scenario, that there's going to be, you know, increased instability in that region. So it's something we need to also think about for the global economy.
A detail here from your footnotes, the CIA fact book, guesswork is one way to identify how they consistently have changed their opinion of how many Farsi-speaking Persians there are in Iran. My notes say from 2000 to 2011, the CIA factbook said there were 51% Persianists in the whole country and 24% Azerbaijani. In 2011 to the present, the CIA factbook said that 61% of the country was Persian and 16% Azerbaijani. These numbers are based on guesswork, on research. What do you make of it, Professor? Because your book is filled with footnotes where you get your information.
Right. So, well, first thing, the CIA stopped publishing. The last time they published an assessment of numbers was 2015. Now, if you go to the fact book, you'd see ethnic groups, and it says Persians, Azerbaijanis, Gilans, Kurds, without any numbers, which means that they don't have a number they feel comfortable, you know, about publishing. But most Western publications will go back to these earlier numbers of the CIA and say, no, Persians are, you know, 61%. I always think the 1% is the funniest thing, because how do you know the, you know, ethnicity? It's not blood. It's identity, right? How do you know the level of the resolution of 1%? I think that's quite funny. But I was very lucky to have access to Iranian internal documents, that internal surveys about language capacity, fluency, attitudes, ethnic identity, and it's really hard to make the case that the Persians are more than even 40% in Iran.
Yes, I would say I'm comfortable with the 40% number. And you mentioned to me that the birth rate is very high in the ethnic areas and not in the Persian areas. So the future is more ethnic. We're going to turn to sport next. Why? Because it's a major political concern. Right now, there's a young man condemned or possibly condemned to death who was a member of the Iranian team that participated in the World Cup. What about soccer and protest? Brenda Schaefer is the author of the new book, Iran is More Than Persia, Ethnic Politics in Iran. I'm John Bashley.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Bachelor.